So it's long been many people's opinion that if you're going to watch an award show, you should probably watch the Tonys if you're only going to watch one, because the people involved in the Tonys are implicitly comfortable with performing live, whereas the people on the Emmys and the Oscars are not necessarily so. And so last night was the Tonys, a different hosting configuration, a few surprises. Frank Rizzo's joining us. He's the go-to guy for theater in Connecticut, theater writer for the Hartford Current and for Variety. Frank, welcome to the show. I already know some of your opinions by watching your Twitter feed from last night.
Well, the show is always interesting, and I had a lot of surprises in terms of the awards. It was the most, it had the biggest upset, actually, in terms of the big award of the night, the Best Musical, since I think this goes back to Wicked, when Wicked and Avenue Q were going head-to-head in this little show, this tiny little show with puppets called Avenue Q knocked the giant off its perch. Now, American in Paris wasn't quite of Wicked proportions, but it's a big hit, and it's going to do very well, and it's a terrific show, by the way. And actually, the Bushnell has some dough in it in terms of its investment. But the big winner of the night was Fun Home, this little show that people just love. And actually, I think it had the best musical segment of the night with this wonderful little girl in it.
Yeah, this is a wonderful little girl. She's 11 years old. I think her name is Sydney Lucas.
Yes.
And so she did this song called Ring of Keys. Although I have to say, I thought she was terrific. I thought her delivery of that song was terrific. It wasn't really a song that made me say, I've got to get tickets to this show right now.
No, but it wasn't the hard sell, but it was an intimate sell. And I think the audience watching it really got to know the sense of what the show is all about. And it just focused and settled on one performer giving this wonderful, tender song that pretty much reflected what the show is about, as opposed to this horrible mishmash of, did anyone know in America know what the hell is going on with The Visit or On the 20th Century? Suddenly there were these, eunuchs in whiteface with Cheetah Rivera, and even though Cheetah was lovely in the moment, the scene itself was not very good, and I wouldn't be surprised if they post their closing notice today.
Yeah, you're bringing up all kinds of things that I want to talk about as we go along, but I want to come back to Fun Home for a second. But
sure.
Before we do that, we do have to say that whatever we thought of that number, and I agree it was very uninspiring, the number from The Visit. You know, I mean, just for those of us who are getting on in years, Cheetah Rivera is 82 years old and delivering a full-fledged number in which
absolutely
she seemed completely legitimate. I mean, she's the hope I'm clinging to right now for myself, Frank.
Well, she's a hope we're all clinging to, because she is, and actually theater people in general have a happy, long life on stage. If you think of James Earl Jones, if you think of Hal Holbrook, if you think of Angela Lansbury, they're all in their 80s or 90s and giving 8 performances a week. God bless them. And very good performances at that. So I'm glad Cheetah was nominated, but I'm glad Kelly won.
Yeah.
Kelly O'Hara for King and I.
Yeah, it's sort of the ages of women now, as you go from playing Desiree in A Little Night Music to playing the Hermione Gingold role, because you get to sit down. But let's come back to Fun Home, because what we haven't really said is what this musical is. This is, first of all, there are few enough new musicals, completely brand new musicals that don't repurpose other material on Broadway anyway. There are even fewer new musicals. This is something that was talked about yesterday. You and I were at Long Wharf, that involved, pretty much all women creative teams.
Absolutely. It's the first time that co-creators of the music, as well as the book, won Tonys for those awards. It was a good night for women in general. The director for the best play of the year, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, was a woman. So, women did very, very well last night.
Yeah, although it's especially good to be a British woman.
Because, a British woman certainly helps.
Yeah.
But none of the Fun Home people were British, and it was a completely homegrown and all-American show, so to speak.
True. The best director of a play for Curious Dog is Marianne Elliott, who's British, and of course Dame Helen Mirren had a great night. Well, let's talk about Fun Home. This is the story. It's essentially a story based on the story of Alison Bechdel,
based on her graphic novel.
Right, and it's a story of a closeted dad, and also the kind of coming of age and coming of awareness of a young woman as a lesbian, and as such. Maybe a kind of unlikely fodder for a musical. I mean, there's even more grim stuff in there that maybe we don't want to do any more spoilers. But it's, you know, this isn't,
I think
Music Man.
Tony voters were responding to that and how well it was presented. Actually, if anything, it sort of reminded me of William Finn's Falsetto's musicals in dealing with subject matter and tone, that it's very smart. Very funny, very musical, but at the same time, you know, talking about very personal and not so much feel-good subject matter.
And as I say, I do think, boy, for Sydney Lucas, and it's sort of, you know, this the way they shoot it, too, she really has to kind of hold a close-up. This young woman is 10 or 11. I think she's 11, yeah.
She held the stage of Radio City Music Hall. This little 11-year-old girl, and, you know, was completely poised but assured without being that, you know, icky, you know, a child precociousness that we all kind of cringe at.
You know, so much to talk about. You were alluding to the fact that some shows wait to see if they could possibly win enough Tonys to sort of restart the life support mechanism. So this is one of the things you as a theater writer will now watch over the next few days. You mentioned The Visit as a show that might not be able to stay open now.
Right.
Are there any other? I mean, for example, you know, Disgraced has been running a really long time. I don't know.
Disgraced closed.
Oh, it has closed. Okay.
Right. It had a respectable run. It's going to be done everywhere, including Long Wharf Theater. They're
right.
Going to open their season with Disgraced. So it's going to have a nice life in the theater. But in terms of musicals, the big loser here was The Visit. But no one actually thought it was going to get the best musical, but there were hopes that Cheetah would. And actually, my guess is that the producers were hoping that Cheetah would not get it, because then they'd be obligated to keep the show open because Cheetah won the award. Now they can reasonably close it with full honors.
Right. This is something that sort of came to light. I think some of the writing that you and other people did after after A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder won the Tony last year, the Hartford Stage Generated one, which is, it really is great if you win the Tony.
Absolutely.
But it's not great like the next day, right? You've got to sort of build
up.
Yeah.
It is absolutely. Today's box office for Fun Home is going to go through the roof. It's going to propel Fun Home, and it's already going to boost its tour that's going to begin in 2016. The big question is, will the Bushnell pick it up, or will it ignore yet another Tony Award winning musical? It passed on Gentleman's Guide for their Broadway season under the excuse that Hartford Stage has already done it. If they don't do Fun Home, then I'd question the Bushnell's commitment to showing us the best of Broadway.
Ooh, the gauntlet has been thrown down, David.
So why not?
Yeah, Frank Rizzo has challenged you now. So there, you know, there's a lot of different conversations that are going on, kind of subtly, or maybe even not so subtly, at the Tonys, and particularly this year. I think one of the not very subtle undercurrents was this kind of sense that yes. These are the plays and musicals that enjoy the highest esteem of Broadway insiders, but not necessarily the only plays that can do well. And so there was a Finding Neverland, which is had this kind of curious and very aggressive marketing strategy that started last year on the Tonys when it wasn't even being staged.
Everyone wondered, where was Jennifer Hudson?
Right. Jennifer Hudson last year was part of this musical number from Finding Neverland on the Tonys, although the Finding Neverland was not at that point on stage. And so this year, it's you know, it, 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 didn't get any big awards. It didn't really get...
It got no awards.
Yeah.
Nominations, I mean. So it didn't get any awards either. But it's doing more than $1 million a week at the box office. So Harvey Weinstein can sit in that audience and have a big old smile on his face.
Right. And so
Harvey Weinstein being the producer of the show, a Hollywood producer, and it's his first Broadway musical to produce.
Yeah. And so, and he's done some things, some very commercially canny things about this, including you may have seen Jennifer Lopez introduce one of the segments, and that's because she appears on this, not exactly the cast album. Like, there's like an album of music being sung by people who aren't in the play, but who are a lot more bankable than the play, right?
I know. You know, it's kind of shocking in a way, but you know, he's a good businessman.
And
good marketer.
And so there's a sort of, I mean, it's interesting. And so one of the, there's so that kind of marketing, plus the fact that you've got Matthew Morris and Kelsey Grammer, names people know, attached to a story people know and are comfortable with and are not going to be put off by. They get it. They've seen, you know, nine other kind of repurposings of the Peter Pan story. So you can work with that. And the other person who also was not nominated, his play was not nominated, didn't really get some really got some actually fairly bad reviews, was Larry David, who is entering the Broadway marketplace. And Larry David, we're going to talk with Frank in just a second about sort of the tone of last night, which I thought was, you know, for the most part, a little bit muted and not full of exciting surprises or incandescence. But Larry David, of course, as he will, introduced maybe one, you know, a squirmable moment quite intentionally. So actually, we're going to play that audio right now.
Let me tell you something, okay? The true measure of a man is not to be nominated and still show up to read a list of names of those who are nominated. That's a big man. That's a big, big man.
You say big man, others might say loser.
Loser. You know, if by loser you're referring to a man who's greeted 8 times a week by 1,000 people who stand as one, applauding until their hands are raw, cheering until their voices are spent, whispering he's so much better looking in person, and laughing until their faces are contorted in an anguish mask that can best be described as a sort of Bell's palsy. People who, if it were up to them, would put aside the obvious anti-Semitism. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I said it, the anti-Semitism that denies a nomination to a Larry David or a Harvey Weinstein, yeah. Then yes, I am a loser.
So not the only joke that folded Harvey Weinstein into it. He seemed to be having a pretty good time, though.
But that clip was absolutely hysterical. I would have loved to have had Larry David host the show, because Larry David is funny, unlike the material Kristen Chenoweth and Alan Cumming had, which were completely staggeringly unfunny. When Neil Patrick Harris came out at the very end of the show, I couldn't help but think that he was thinking to himself, not so easy, is it, Kristen?
Right. We have to talk a little bit about this. So Neil Patrick Harris and Hugh Jackman have both kind of established themselves as just these kind of amazingly good hosts of this show. Neil Patrick Harris, of course, has extended that brand into other venues and then like didn't do so well with the Oscars and maybe played around even with one of his so-called, you know, at least what was said to be sort of a comedic failure at the Oscars, made a little joke about himself last night. But he's really, really good at this.
Yeah.
Well, Alan Cumming and Kristen Chenoweth are gigantic talents. I mean, they're both really good. They can both do a lot of things. I mean, Alan Cumming could do everything from The Good Wife to a one-man version of Macbeth to Cabaret. But, you know, I totally agree that somehow or other, this thing started out kind of – weekly, and then it just kind of stayed weak in terms of what they were able to bring by way of electricity.
The special material that they were giving was just lame. They didn't particularly handle it that well. The running gags were bad, and I think Kristen at some point should have said, no, I am not going into that E.T. outfit. It's not funny. It doesn't make sense. And besides, that's a movie joke. That's not particularly funny to begin with.
Yeah.
So it just had all these just bad choices throughout the show. And it would have been better if they just, you know, introduced everyone and get off the stage. They were just not very good.
We're talking to Frank Rizzo, theater writer for the Hartford Current and Variety. I have to say this may mark me out as a lowbrow. That was sort of the one of the few times. I was also watching it with kids, which may have affected a little bit. But she did come out dressed as E.T. and just stood there for no reason. And finally, Alan Cumming said, no, I said fun home.
Yeah, really big yuck.
Well, it was a little
cringeworthy. Yuck. It was a cringeworthy at least if they were going for a bold, provocative joke, I could have at least given them points. But they were going for a bad joke that just didn't land whatsoever. But she was a terrific performer, and so was he. I didn't think that they had particularly good chemistry together. I think they're going to be going, the producers are going to be going on their hands and knees back to Neil Patrick or Hugh Jackman or my choice, Larry David.
That will never happen.
That's in my fantasy, yeah. Tony Award show.
There's a pretty weak chance that that will ever happen.
Yeah.
So, and you know, the other thing that surprised me a little bit is, so what does Kristen Chenoweth do better than almost anybody around these days? I mean, she really is one of the great Broadway singers. She just has this just incredibly electric voice. And they've typically begun the show with some big production number that, you know, that Neil Patrick Harris, who's like an okay singer, would do, or Hugh Jackman, who's a pretty good singer. But I mean, Kristen Chenoweth is just off the charts. They didn't do that. They didn't let her do the one thing where she could have killed.
Well, that's because she was attached to the hip with Alan, who's not a great singer. He's a very good actor. He can, you know, act, sing a song, but he's nowhere in the same musical comedy chops that Kristen has, or Neil Patrick Harris, or Hugh Jackman. He just doesn't. So, but what are you going to do? You have the two co-hosts. You just can't say, can you step aside while I do my big number?
Well, I wondered if also one of the shows that was sort of in consideration last night was Something Rotten. Something Rotten sort of takes place in the era of Shakespeare. It's about these two guys who kind of want to be competitors of Shakespeare, but it has Shakespearean characters in it too. But they had this sort of pre-made Tony opening song in there. It's in which Nostradamus somehow shows up and predicts that there's going to be something someday called a musical to these completely uncomprehending Elizabethan people. What are you talking about, this musical? And so in a way, they might have just looked at that and said, wow, it really is. It was like it was made to open the Tonys, and
right,
our writers get the day off too.
Exactly. That's what they should have done. Instead, it comes in a little bit later in the show. It's a wonderful number, beautifully done. It came a little bit too late because Alan and Kristen kind of stopped the show before it even began with their lame opening number.
You said, I think you tweeted, that you were enjoying some of the acceptance speeches. And
oh, very much.
We can talk about one or two of them, although I want to begin by saying that Ruthie Ann Miles from The King and I made history in an odd way, right?
The recycling.
Yeah.
And reading her acceptance speech, not from a rolled-up napkin on the back of a program, but from her iPhone. I think she made history twice. To mention she's probably the first Asian actor to win an award in quite some time.
Right. So, yeah, she went paperless and read all of her thank you stuff. Because there really is this, I can't remember who it was, but there was some person who last night, some actress or other esteemed person who seemed to be trying to dig a Post-it out of, like, the folds of her dress somewhere. I'm thinking, it was like, just don't do that. That doesn't look good.
I know. I think it was Kelly O'Hara who she started off, or whoever it was, it started out so well. well, and then suddenly her hands, you know, sort of went into her dress and pulled out this little tiny piece of paper with all the obligatory thank yous. But in Kelly's defense, it was a lovely speech, and she had the best exit of receiving an award that I've ever seen. That wonderful dance jig that she did as she went off the stage.
Ruthie Ann Miles may have sort of judged the moment correctly by going paperless, and I thought Kelly O'Hara may have judged the moment correctly by thinking, I can be a GIF or JIF, depending on how we are. How do we decide we're going to pronounce it?
Oh, I've never figured that out.
No, I was just looking at Wolfie because we keep having arguments about it. But she it was almost as if she knew. Mm. I can go viral. This is going to be perfect. I can be a Vine. I can be a GIF. I can, you know. And so she sort of got that moment right. Was there another acceptance speech in particular? Well, we should say one of the most moving ones in the way that things go these days was Jeanine Tesori and Lisa Kron for Fun Home, which wasn't shown as part of the telecast.
And actually, I would say some of the best acceptance speeches were not shown. Of course, people can see them on YouTube and other theater sites. But actually, the best one was Jeanine Tesori for Fun Home and Lisa Kron, who wrote the book for Fun Home. And they were so moving and so articulate. And I mean, it's really a tragedy that all of America couldn't hear that acceptance speech in prime time, because it was terrific.
And yesterday at the Long Wharf, we were talking about how hard it is for women, and Kron at the end said it's statistically 10% better than it used to be for women on Broadway. It's unacceptably low, but it seems that perhaps we're making some progress. Let me ask you this, Frank. I mean, you see a lot of theater. You're going to see most of these plays, or you've already seen most of these plays anyway. Did you feel as though at the end of last night, there was something you had to go rush and see?
Well, I've seen most of these. I was most concerned on The Town, because it's a terrific show. It really is. It's not as fantastic as American in Paris, which really is sublime beyond words. But it's a terrific, very good show. And that's the big question of how that wonderful show is going to do now that it really didn't take home any awards. But it had a wonderful segment that that was shown. A lot of the plays are no longer on board, but I think Fun Home is the one to see, or to see again, because I think a lot of people who might have pushed that to the side will now make it a point to check out.
Yeah, I like the On the Town guy. He sort of cruised through the audience at the beginning and pulled up Cheetah Rivera for a quick spin, and I think Ruth Wilson after that. Well, listen, Frank Russo, it's so great to talk to you, and you are the guy. You are the guy. You're the guy. Certainly, you watch the Tonys as well as any human being could watch the Tonys.
It's a lot of fun. So I'll see you at the theater, Colin.
Yeah, I'll probably see you at Audra McDonald tonight, actually.
Tonight, you bet.
All right. Thanks for joining us today. Bye-bye. So that's the Tonys. We're going to switch gears now and come back with a very different segment about a complicated case in a Connecticut court that will be materially affected by a very highly publicized Supreme Court decision from last week, a decision about threatening online. As the trial of a man accused of threatening a Connecticut judge is winding down, heading towards closing arguments, there's been a sudden continuance in the trial because of a highly publicized U.S. Supreme Court decision that was issued last week, the so-called Ilonis case, which is also about threatening using the Internet. This is the Facebook case in which a man who was upset with his wife and his coworkers was writing some pretty scary stuff about them on Facebook. The Supreme Court ultimately decided that his state of mind in writing these things was more important, the more decisive factor than how it affected the people who subsequently read these things. So joining us right now is Rachel Baird. She's the attorney representing Edward Topier, whose case may in fact be influenced by this decision. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Colin. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, quickly tell us about this case and your client.
This case started a trial in April of 2015. We had approximately 11 days of evidence. It was a trial before a judge, not a jury. And so at the end of evidence, the judge gave both sides opportunity to brief the issue, and we were going to hold closing arguments on June 2nd, and on June 1st, the Alonis decision issued, and I filed a motion for continuance to determine the impact of Alonis on the case. The judge granted my motion, and now the argument is set down for June 23rd for both sides to weigh in on the impact of Alonis and any other issues that they want to bring forward, obviously.
So let me try to set this up a little, and you can correct me when I get things wrong, which I inevitably will. But so my understanding of this is that this was an ongoing dispute in which Ted Topier was unhappy with his ex-wife and also unhappy with the functioning of the court system. Like a lot of people these days, he's kind of revved up about guardians ad litem and other aspects of family court. We've seen this kind of boiling over in some other contexts over the last year or two. He was sending an email, I think, to six people involved in the family court reform movement. So the email was not to Judge Elizabeth Pizzuto, but it did describe how upset he was with Elizabeth Pizzuto, and then went on to describe things like where she lives, what kind of windows there are there, what would basically happen if you shot at one of those windows. And at the end he says, or in this email it says, they can steal my kids from my cold, dead, bleeding, cordite-filled fists. As my 60-round mag falls to the floor and I'm dying, I change out to the next 30-round. So this is kind of tough language. I don't know whether you've stipulated yet to the idea that he sent that email.
We have not. There are obviously two components of this case, and one of them is we're holding the state to its burden of proof that it actually proves that Mr. Topier sent the email. And then our position is that even if a court could find that there's beyond reasonable doubt that he did, that the words in the email do not constitute a true threat, and that as an ancillary and interesting issue in this case, there's no proof of any intention that it actually reach Judge Pizzuto, and that it was an email intended for what we've described in the case is a loose-knit group of individuals who support family court reform in Connecticut and on occasion talk about it in a context that they all understand to be simply venting.
My recollection is that when Ted Topier was arrested, he was arrested with considerable force, or at least there was a huge police presence showing up at his house.
Well, interestingly enough, the police did show up on August 29th at his house with what's called a risk warrant, which is a civil warrant that authorizes the police to seize guns and ammunition in the state of Connecticut. They also arrived with an arrest warrant. They did not arrive with any search warrant for any computer devices or any computer equipment, and they never did seize any such items from Mr. Topier's house. So our position, one of our positions in this case, is that it was always more about his possession of firearms than whatever happened with computers or didn't happen with computers.
How big a difference do you think the Supreme Court decision makes? I mean, obviously we live in a new era where, you know, if I write something on the internet, if I send out an email blast to six people, it's difficult for me to know or anticipate who's going to wind up reading it. Same with Alonis and his Facebook posts. You know, there's only so much control you can exercise over this. And so I think we were sort of hearing the argument made that, well, whether he intended this to get to Judge Pizzuto or not, or whether Alonis intended for his ex-wife to see this or not, people wind up seeing these things. They circulate more freely in this environment than, say, a paper letter would have 30 years ago. So you were already making this argument prior to the Alonis decision that you still can't say that he had any intention of threatening Elizabeth Pizzuto.
We were already making the argument. The state, in the Tolpier case, charged that he acted with a reckless intent. They did not charge intentional conduct, but reckless conduct. And specifically in Alonis, the majority, the seven-member majority of the court, left the issue of recklessness open for another day. And we argued to Judge Gold last week that this Tolpier case in Connecticut, in fact, presents that opportunity of another day to decide whether recklessness is enough of a mental state to overcome a First Amendment guarantee of the right to express oneself. And in the Tolpier case, there's an added component of we're arguing this is, in fact, political speech. This is about a matter of public importance. It's not just about, as an Alonis, posting things about what I understand was, his ex-wife, an FBI agent, and other individuals where it's hard to argue that it's, in fact, political speech. And so we looked at the jury instruction that the district court in Alonis used, and we're arguing it's very similar to the jury instruction that would, in fact, be used under recklessness in Connecticut. And so, therefore, even though the Supreme Court did not decide the issue of recklessness, if you look at the jury instruction they rejected and compare it to the Connecticut jury instruction, then our argument is that, in fact, recklessness is not enough, and you have to hold people to a higher mental state if you're going to chill their First Amendment expression, especially if that First Amendment expression involves political speech.
I'm obviously not a lawyer, but just for just to help you keep your argumentation skills sharp in this particular case, let me just sort of offer a counter argument. I don't know the Alonis case really well, but my recollection was that he sort of almost kind of tagged many of the things that he posted by sort of saying that he was expressing his First Amendment rights or sort of invoking that notion. One of the things he links to is a comedy video by the whitest kids in the room. About this whole sort of question of whether you can get arrested for threatening somebody, threatening the president, he writes about threatening his wife. But it seemed as though running through this was a little bit of a ticker that was going, kind of Alonis being a little bit aware of the fact that this he might have to sort of defend his actions on First Amendment grounds, and he kind of expressed that a few times. Whereas looking at Mr. Tolpier's email, it obviously, he's interested in a political question, as you say, and the political question is family court reform. But the place he's in trouble doesn't seem political at all. It seems as though he's really mad at this judge, and he's talking about, you know, what kind of house she has and what her windows are like and what it would be like to shoot at that house and how prepared he is to keep firing under any circumstances. To me, so are you sort of arguing an NBA continuation rule that since he was engaged in political speech about family court reform at the beginning, this counts as political speech too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would certainly argue differently that in Alonis he wasn't engaged in that he was not engaged in political speech, and I know what you're referring to, that he used a lot of references almost as if he were teasing the argument of the First Amendment, which almost makes it, in our viewpoint, less of a First Amendment issue. I mean, Mr. Tolpier was, if the state is to be believed and they present evidence that he in fact sent the email, then Mr. Tolpier was in fact arguing a political issue. He was also engaged in First Amendment expression. One of the things that came out at the court trial, similar to Alonis and in him using certain references that are commonly known, I mean, the reference about the mag is a direct reference to what Charlton Heston said in front of many people many times, is his famous saying. And so that in effect it falls, you know, under a similar category of what Alonis did, but more importantly, in Mr. Tolpier's case, I mean, he sent it to a loose-knit or community of individuals whom he understood to share his point of view. And Justice Roberts, at oral argument in Alonis on December 1st of 2014, basically said the same thing. If you go into an internet chat room full of teenagers, they're going to be speaking in a certain way. And if you take what they say out of the context and put it in another context, then it's very likely a lot of people are going to be very alarmed about this. And so it all has to do with the context in which it's spoken. And once we start taking things that people say, you know, in the privacy of their homes or in the privacy of their emails, or I guess it remains to be seen how it's interpreted, how private, you know, Facebook pages are, whether they're limited to certain people or whether they're more open to others, it's going to eventually chill speech among people who understand what they're saying to each other, but they're concerned that if it's overheard or transmitted to somebody else and it's interpreted in a much different way, they could end up being arrested. So the context has to be looked at. And that's what we argued repeatedly in the case, that the context of the email had to be looked at as to how the six recipients had been involved in family court and had experienced similar frustrations among other people.
Although one of the six recipients was alarmed enough and troubled enough, I think she said that she felt his pain on the one hand and understood that, from her point of view, a person who was feeling a lot of pain over the way the system was working against him might write such a thing. But she also was alarmed enough to do something about it. So, I mean, in the context of that group of six anyway, there was at least one person who said, wow, I don't think this should necessarily stay in this group of six.
Well, let me just clarify that. She received the email on August 23rd, and all this is based on the evidence. And she made numerous phone calls to other people who did not share the alarm, did not pass it on. And then Mr. Topier, on the next Wednesday, August 27th, went to a Cromwell school to videotape his children being taken from the school forcibly by the Cromwell Police Department. And when this individual, who ultimately reported the email, saw that video, she became concerned that if Mr. Topier saw the video, then he would become even more upset. And that's what led her to actually not report the email to the police, but to report it to an attorney who then spoke to her bosses about it, who then called the clerk of the court, who then referred her to two other people, and she got voicemail, who then she ultimately reached a judicial marshal, who then is the one who ultimately contacted the police. So the facts of the case are a little more convoluted than somebody simply becoming concerned and calling the police.
Yeah, that is quite a chain of information custody. Well, I mean, Rachel Baird, you're an advocate, you're an attorney, you're doing the best job you can for your client. It's not your job at this point to think about broader ramifications or what this means for society and stuff. But you know, even so, given that, I'm going to ask you a question like that anyway. Does it alarm you at all in any way? I mean, I think some people, they listen to this case, they listen to the Alonis case, and they think, wow, you know, it really makes other people kind of vulnerable to threats, as long as the threats are couched a certain way, or menacing language, or intimidating language if it's couched a certain way, and if the maker of the threats couches his behavior and is careful to maybe be aware of this case law and does it exactly the right way, we could be living in a society where just that kind of intimidation goes flying around all the time and has a different kind of chilling effect, the chilling effect of making people very, very afraid of other people. And as I say, I know it's not your job to worry about that. Is there any part of you that thinks somewhere out there is a line that needs to get drawn?
Well, we're always going to have laws that prohibit threatening. It's just a matter of what you have to show that constitutes a true threat. And what the Supreme Court indicated in Alonis is negligence isn't enough. We're arguing that recklessness isn't enough because that will chill the First Amendment beyond what it's intended to be. I mean, certainly intentionally threatening somebody with an intention to place them in fear is something that's illegal, prohibited, and that's not going to change soon. But putting a chilling effect on the First Amendment that makes people afraid to speak out to people that they understand they can talk to because they are frustrated. I think it's far more dangerous to prohibit people from venting their frustrations to people that they believe understand, because just because you prohibit somebody from saying something doesn't mean that they're not going to do it. And don't we want people to have the ability to vent their frustrations and talk to other people and have people understand and perhaps commiserate and have things dealt with that way better than prohibiting people from speaking out at all?
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely want that, although if this were a friend of mine, I would advise him against using the kind of language and imagery that this guy used. So, Rachel Baird, I know you have to go. I know your time is limited. So set us up for the rest of this. So you'll be back in court on June 23rd arguing this point?
We will, and we're going through the transcripts now, the 11 days of testimony. We're reviewing case law that's similar to this, and we certainly hope to present a compelling argument on June 23rd why legally the case should not go forward and why factually it should be found in Mr. Topher's favor.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. We'll be back for a final segment. It'll be about Saturday's Belmont Stakes. One of the horses, not the one who made history, but one of the horses who ran pretty well, was owned at least partly by two men from North Haven. We'll talk to one of them after this.
Combine the Tonys and the Belmont and have the actors run around a track to get their statuettes. Today's show was produced by Tucker Ives and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Anna Geismar, Pally St. Germain, and Allison Ehrenreich. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Tommy Toon. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff's huge Bob Fosse dance number, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, a logo cast, which is a word I just made up for a show about people who make up new words. And now, back to Colin.
The 37-year wait is over. American Pharoah is finally the one. American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown.
So that's what you heard on Saturday. And, of course, the big news of the day, indisputably, was that American Pharoah, for the first time in 37 years, was a Triple Crown winner. It's been a long wait. I think President Carter was president last time there was a Triple Crown winner. But as the race unfolded, there were those of us who were cheering for other horses. Partly because some of us had bet a lot of exactas that didn't involve American Pharoah, and part of us because everybody loves an underdog. So one of the underdogs or underhorses was a horse known as Keen Ice. We're going to talk to John Buckley, actually John Buckley of North Haven, one of the owners of Keen Ice. First of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Colin.
And speaking of show, congratulations. Keen Ice finished third. So first of all, how did you come to be a racehorse owner? I assume you are a petrochemical magnate multi-billionaire.
Not quite. Maybe someday that will come my way, but that hasn't yet. I got involved almost 30 years ago, I guess. It was my dad had decided that once he put all his kids through school that he would get involved in owning some racehorses. He ended up buying some or claiming some horses up at Suffolk Downs in Boston. I watched him. He taught me the game. And a few years later, I was involved in the business myself. So it's almost been almost 30 years now that I've been involved in horse ownership. And to get down there for the Belmont and be a part of history doesn't get any better than that.
Well, it does get slightly better. I mean, it gets better when your horse finishes first. But I would imagine this was kind of a cool thing on a number of levels. As you say, this was history. And it's not like your horse finished totally out of the money, too. So there's sort of two good things happen, right?
Absolutely. To be a part of American Pharoah's day and what he did is so good for racing. Special day down there. If you could have felt the energy down there, it was amazing. But then to have a participant and a horse that shows up that runs about as well as he can run right now in his developmental pattern, we were thrilled.
Tell us about Keen Ice. Well, what can you give us a little sense of who this horse is?
Keen Ice is a horse that I got involved in about 6-7 months ago. There's a fellow by the name of Jerry Crawford who runs a partnership by the name of Donegal Stable, does a tremendous job. He had this colt that I had noticed running the Remsen, which is a race that's run in November at Aqueduct. He was a horse that made up some ground that day, and I became interested in him at that time, started having conversations with Jerry, who was the founder and the principal of the partnership, and became involved in Keen Ice. He's a big, strong, strapping colt. He's bred to run all day long. He looks the part. He's thick, a big shoulder, and it was a thrill to be a part of it.
And you weren't just a part of this, right? Keen Ice ran in the Derby as well.
Yeah, we were down there for the Derby as well. He ran seventh, what we thought was a fast-closing seventh in the Kentucky Derby, and then we took the Preakness off and came back to take another shot at American Pharoah in the Belmont.
Is this, you said you've been in the horse game a little bit for many, many years now. Is this the first time you've had a horse run those two races?
This is the first time I've ever participated on this level of the business. I've owned horses with two other partners, a fellow and another guy in North Haven by the name of Ralph Durante, and I have owned horses for the last 17 or 18 years together. We played mostly at the claiming allowance and then occasional stakes horse race. We had never had a horse involved in the Triple Crown. We got involved with Jerry Crawford and Donegal because we thought we'd have a chance to do that with his partnerships. And this was our first time, our first trip to Kentucky, our first trip to the Belmont Stakes to actually be a part of it.
I would assume getting a taste of that would be pretty seductive.
You're absolutely right. It's hard to play anything at the highest level and not enjoy being part of it. It's a tremendous ride.
Were you surprised to hear that American Pharoah is basically going to run out the rest of the year, run in other venues? Did that surprise you?
It did not surprise me because Ahmed Zayat, is a true sportsman. He loves the game. Really, the intrigue here is when you've got something special like that is to share it with the public, particularly the racing public, and let them be a part of that horse. I don't think that for him it's all about the money. It's about the sportsman piece of it, and that's great for the game.
So what kind of year is Keen Ice going to have from here on in? People who are listening to this here in Connecticut might want to see Keen Ice run at Saratoga Springs or someplace close by. Is there any chance of that?
Yeah, you know, I was listening to Jerry Crawford, the managing partner, speak after the race, and I think that it's undecided at this point in time. I think that there may be some thought that they want to try this colt on the grass at some point in time, but I think everything's still on the table when you've been through this grueling mile and a half. I think they got to kind of let them down a little bit, let him return to being a horse, and then put together a plan depending upon where he's at and what he wants. In my mind, Donegal races horses. They'll have horses at Saratoga. It would not surprise me if he ran there. It likewise wouldn't surprise me if they sent him to somewhere like Arlington Park and ran on the grass.
As of last Friday, there were a lot of people saying, well, it's just not ever going to happen again for a whole bunch of different reasons. Everybody had this kind of rationale about why there just isn't going to be a Triple Crown winner. And of course, and then you had the sort of the California Chrome people from last year saying, well, you know, also it's, you know, some people rest their horses and it's not fair and all this kind of stuff. And so that's all kind of out the window now. And you sort of wonder, you know, right after Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile mark, a lot of people broke the 4-minute mile mark. Does it make you think maybe within 2, 3, 4, 5 years we might see this happen again, or does it not work that way?
I don't think it works that way. I don't think it works that way anymore because we breed horses differently. Horses are not bred to do what these horses are doing. They're bred to sprint more than they are to go a distance or ground, and they're not trained anymore to run three races in 5 weeks. It's just not the way that they go at the business any longer. And when a horse does this in the current environment, which is much different than it was 50 years ago, it is a tremendous feat. You really have to have a horse that I think is just that much better than the rest.
Now, how old is Keen Ice now? I'm sorry that I don't know that.
He's a 3-year-old, and all of the horses that run in the series, yeah, the Triple Crown, are all 3-year-olds, and he is, of course, a 3-year-old.
What's next for you? I mean, do you have another horse that's coming up through the ranks right now, or is that a decision you make later?
One of the great things about our involvement with Donegal is that we're involved in a group of 2-year-olds. We have 5 or 6 2-year-olds that we're involved in for next year, and hope springs eternal, obviously. Keen Ice will continue to do what he does, and I think the hope with all of these horses is that they continue to get better because some athletes peak as junior in high schools and some don't figure it out until they're 21. So you're hoping that with all of them they continue to improve. But as far as this is concerned, we're involved in a group of 2-year-olds that will be going to the track probably within the next month or so. We hope to see a couple of those up at Saratoga make their debut, which is a special event. And then hopefully we've got something to talk about next year as well when it's Derby time. But that's what we're looking at.
Well, John Buckley, congratulations. I couldn't be happier for you unless I hadn't lost $42 betting against American Pharoah.
That's great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. This is great for racing, and thank you for covering it. And I hope people come out and enjoy this sport as much as I do.
That's our show for today. Thanks to everybody who helped make it possible. Tomorrow, we're doing a show about new words and people who make up new words. So if you've ever wondered what Nipster or Charmalade are, or if you'd prefer not to have ever known, either way, join us here at the same time.
One more time, out on the track, saddle.
I don't understand how all these horses put up with it. I mean, their bosses are riding them all day. Who do they think they are? I mean, get off your high horse. Am I right?